Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're speaking with Paul Wilson from Monster Kitchen at Overlo Nishi in Canberra about his time learning about vegetables at Geranium Restaurant in Copenhagen and about the Overlo Hotel's Year of the Veg. Welcome to another episode of the Food Fight Podcast. My name's Steph Postuma, your host, alongside my co-host, Mr. Simon Evans.
Hiya.
Of Night Parrot and Kavo Glory in the favourite steel city of Wollongong. And we sit here in the dining room of Monster Restaurant Overlo Nishi in Canberra with executive chef Paul Wilson. G'day, Paul.
How you going, guys?
Good, mate. Thank you so much for joining us. We start our podcast with an acknowledgement of country, and traveling with this podcast is great, getting to explore some of the different regions of New South Wales and the ACT. So we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land where we gather here today, and pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. All right, guys, let's kick it off. Paul, for people that don't know much about your background as a chef, let's do it, because I think that it's interesting and it's important to get out of the way before we start talking about the Year of the Veg and what Overlo is doing through all their venues here in Australia and in Asia too, I believe.
Yeah, Hong Kong, and then just opening one up in Bali as we speak.
Cool. So start off with a bit of background, like where you first sort of started cooking and your sort of eventual journey over to Denmark and to Geranium.
Yep. So first cooking job was KFC, actually.
Nice.
13 years old. So that's one of the famous restaurants in the world. That's on my little spiel.
It's one of the biggest restaurants in the world.
Exactly. Damn. Yeah. So, and then did my training, culinary training at Marriott Hotel in North Ryde. So I spent 3 years there, and then realized after that I knew nothing about cooking. It was good foundations, but then I realized there was much more to cooking. So then I went to work at a One Hat restaurant in Sydney City. It was Ad Lib Bistro, owned by Dietmar Sawyer, and then moved on to his sister restaurant, Browwaters Inn, which is a Three Hat restaurant. Spent 2 years there. And then, when the 2007 financial crisis for industry went down, it was he went bankrupt, unfortunately, and then he had to move to Hayman Island. That's where I sort of got into my private island stint. Spent Hayman Island for a little bit, went to Lizard Island for a little bit, then eventually went to Fiji, which was a 85 self-sufficient island. So we had 3 hydroponic tents, 2 outside farms, we had Wagyu cattle, limousine beef, 2 chickens, ducks, quails, everything you can imagine at our doorstep. So we were pretty much growing everything that came on to the menus except for the staples, say carrots, potatoes, onions, just because we were going through so much. So we had 5 restaurants there. I did a 10-course tasting menu, daily changing, so the guests couldn't eat the same meal twice. We had a Thai restaurant, some casual beach clubs and stuff like that. So that's when I really got to learn my style of cooking, because the exec chef gave me free rein to do whatever I wanted at that time. And then took a holiday to Denmark and Europe and ate a lot of restaurants over there. Fell in love with Geranium after the meal I had there. Still to this day, the best meal of my
life. Tell us about that meal.
Walking in, like, I did a lot of research about the place, like, did a lot of online checking out the staff, and the stuff he was doing with food, it didn't look like food, some of the things. So
what was the chef's name?
Rasmus Koford.
Mm-hmm.
So he does the Bocuse d'Or competition, so it's like the cooking Olympics of the world. So he's won bronze, silver and gold, the only chef to ever win all three, and they've made a rule now that when you win a medal, you can't compete again. So he'll go down as history as the godfather of this sort of cooking competition. So it's like 2 years of intense training.
It's quite a traditional competition as well. Like, yeah. It's very French. It's very sort of theatrical in plating. Like, it's obviously very, you know, some amazing chefs have done it, but it is still quite old school, and it does not resemble Nordic cooking.
No.
Like you would think.
Yeah, everything's like picture perfect. You're talking millimeters is between good and bad. So going to Geranium and seeing that kind of level of service, like that meal where the chef served everything, did a lot of stuff table side, first time eating like that. And then during the night, all I saw with Rasmus, he was just picking pine shoots. And I was just like, it was just such a strange thing to see the head chef not even do service. He had so much trust in his staff that they could do everything without him, and he was just picking pine shoots to pickle for the next day.
Wow. And so what sort of things did you see on that first menu, that meal that you experienced? Like, what, for people who don't know about Geranium, it's a 3 Michelin star restaurant in Denmark. You got number 5 in the world's
number
best.
Number 5 at the moment.
Yeah, at the moment. Yeah. You know, what's the style? What's the food?
It's just, so you go in, you have like, you sit in the lounge, if there's space to sit in the lounge to have a few snacks. And then a big piece of wood comes out with this, like, another piece of wood wrapped around it. And that bit was edible artichoke. So it was like an artichoke twill. It's had many different faces now. And now it's in this beautiful lattice-like twill, like a leaf. But yeah, at the time it was just like, bend the twill, deep fry it, and then wrap it around the stick, and then pull it out, and then feed it back through for service. And that's to serve with like a roasted grain mayonnaise. So it's a roasted grain vinegar infused, and then made a mayonnaise out of that. And you get like a little carrot sphere inside. You got liquid fermented carrot juice. And then when you sit down for the meal, the first dish was a edible razor clam. So the technique for this one takes around 2 weeks. It took him 4 years to figure out how to make the edible razor clam
without
shell.
The shell as well.
Yeah, just awesome. To make the pattern on it, to get it super thin, to be able to make it like consistent every time. So they had like a razor clam sitting out of a bowl, and then it looked like seaweed. It just looked like a garnish that wasn't meant to be eaten. Found out afterwards it wasn't meant to be eaten. It was a parsnip twill shaped to look like seaweed. And I sent it back to the kitchen. I didn't even know it was edible. So that happened a lot while I was at Journey, and people would open the razor clam shell, lick out the razor clam tartare and put the shell back together and send it back to the kitchen. And then it'd come back and you'd be like, no.
That probably shows how realistic it looked then. Yeah, at this point, like, that's like, the direction you want. It's like, exactly. Oh, this looks so good, they're going to send it back and I have to send it back to them again.
Exactly. So yeah, when we see that, we're like, no, replayed it and go and explain to them properly that the whole thing is edible, because we had people coming from around the world. So there's some big language barriers. In what sort of edible, so you need to sort of use a bit of sign language to make sure like you can eat everything, or eat this, don't eat that, because we served a lot of things on showpieces. Like we had a scallop stones dipped in dill gel, and they were served on stones, so it kind of camouflaged because the gel was quite dark. So some people might eat the actual rock, some people might leave the stone. So a lot of it was it was just super interesting having to do stuff at the table by yourself, or sourcing at the table. The dish looks beautiful, and then once they add the sauce, it completely changes the dish, things like that, and just flavor combinations I've never even thought of using before. So yeah, I walked out of that meal, like, best meal of my life. Walked home, I was like, I'm gonna come work here one day. Went back to Fiji, did 6 months more there. And then, yeah, time was up. Normally 2 years at a job, I sort of feel as I've learned everything that I can. And then I'll just, if I can progress to another level, or just move on to something fresh. So time came up in Fiji, and I just messaged Geranium, just said, oh, can I do an internship? They said yes, booked in the time, got my visa sorted, one-way ticket to Geranium, started working there, spent a month and a half as a stage. After the first 2 weeks, head chef pulled me aside and figured out that I wanted a job in Denmark. So he's like, we want to hire you straight away, but there's no positions available because our team is quite full. As soon as a spot opens up, you'll be the first one to call. So I was meant to go stage at another restaurant, but because I was going out with the guys in the restaurant and going out partying and stuff, my bank account started to go a little bit low. So I cancelled my second stage and then started working at a One Hat French restaurant, which was a friend of Dronium. Learned a lot of cool techniques there, like on Vessi cooking chicken in a
Butter
and stuff like that, and salt baking fish and doing heaps of tableside stuff. Like we had a sorbet trolley with six sorbets, and in the summer had to go out there and scoop alaminute, offer them the flavors. And then it was 36 degree heat downstairs in the basement, and I had a table of six and they ordered six flavors of sorbet. And then the ice cream was melting because I was there for like 10 minutes. So I just asked the waitress, I'm like, go get me a can of nitrogen. So they've got this big coffee cup of nitrogen. And I just sat there and poured it on top of all the ice creams, on top of all the plates. The whole restaurant just filled up with smoke. And I was just like, they thought it was funny. And I was just trying to scoop these bloody ice cream things. So that was a good experience. And then, yeah, so when Dranium called me, I went to go work there as a chef de partie. And then probably 3 or 4 months after, the head chef, sous chef were a couple. They left together. So sort of everyone started getting promoted up the ranks. And then, chef saw sort of my ambitions and the way I worked and everything like that. So he offered me the sous chef role. After only being there for, I think, 4.5 months. And then, sous chef, there was 2 sous chefs. So I'd look after the first half of the menu, the first 10 courses. And then the other sous chef would look after the rest. The assistant head chef would look after pastry. So we'd all help each other, but like we were in charge of those sections kind of thing. And then, obviously Rasmus being the famous chef he is, he was out and about doing consultants and stuff like that. So we'd be running the kitchen. But he's probably the one chef that he would want to make every single service. Like he wanted to plate every single service. He'd miss maybe the first half, the snacks. As soon as they got into the main course, he's on the pass plating. Making sure everything's there. So it was good to see him. When he's in the kitchen, everyone's just super focused. It's just, not that we weren't beforehand, but it was
an extra little level you go to.
It's just
maybe he's more quiet.
Yeah, but he's very fun. Like he's not an angry chef at all. He's so focused. Like when he does the Bocuse d'Or training, I remember him trying to put these little flowers inside this beetroot glass sphere. And then a stagiaire was walking past him with a tray of something, and he was watching Rasmus do something. He tripped over, dropped the whole tray. Rasmus didn't even flinch. He was just still focusing on putting these little flowers. Like he was, when he goes in the zone, he's just like in the zone.
Yeah, wow.
Kind of thing. So
you know that's when you can drop stuff.
Yeah, it was just...
Wait for him to be doing that.
You can't run in the kitchen, but you can walk very fast. Yeah. It was just like, that was one thing he kept saying to everyone.
How many seats was Geranium?
Geranium was 34. It was up to 45 when I got there, and then they dropped it back a little bit to 35. Mm-hmm. And then we have a private dining room. At one stage, we were doing 80 in the private dining room for functions, and then still 35 in the restaurant. And that was chaotic because when the function, you needed to source things at the table.
Mm.
You needed to grab half the chefs from the main kitchen and then run to the function room. So I was in charge of the function room and R&D for a little bit while I was Sue. And then, just running in, I'm like, can I get 6 hands to source this dish? And then everyone's like, no, I'm busy. I'm like, no, I need 6 hands, right now. I need to source the function, and then you can have everyone can go back. But some of the service things, he wants, one chef to source one plate. We all have to synchronize our spoons, so you can't hear anyone out of sync. Like, that level of service, I've never seen it in Australia.
And same with some of that theatrical stuff, and a lot of stuff serving the table, on first cooking. That's something I've never seen in Australia. I've seen a couple of it in the UK.
Yeah.
Sort of cooked chicken like that. But it's something you don't quite see here. You've seen a bit more chefs going to the table more, but that level of attentiveness and that extra level of trolleys and this, that, you only see it in very few restaurants, where it's much more prevalent in Europe.
Yeah. Just because the execution needs to be on point. Like, everyone can do the trolley, but if you haven't got everything lined up, everything's super clean, like, it falls flat if you go to the table and it just doesn't
well, that synchronizing of the spoons hitting bowls and pouring and stuff is next level.
When you get like 8 people doing it at once, like, the guests are like, what this is going
like,
on?
Like, you sweep the table where you're kind of like lay down and play at the same time. Yeah. Like, got, like, things like that, like, look pretty awesome.
Yeah, just the look on their faces. And then you're just like, yep.
Maybe it's just that staff costs are so high in Australia, we just can't afford to do it here.
Well, how many chefs, how many chefs were at Duranium?
So we had 13 paid chef de parties, 2 sous, an assistant head chef, and then we got up to one stage with 13 stagiaires.
Right.
So it was like
Europe's little secret.
Yeah. Yeah. So stagiaires are great. Like, you get some good ones, you get some doozies, but like most of the time, like, they're there to help you out. So when I was like, even when I was on the chef de party, it was just tell the stagiaires, if you push on prep and you get your prep done, you get to do the fun part, which is service. We'll pull you into service with us. If you don't finish your prep and you go a little bit slow, you're not going to see any service. Everyone wants to do service because we had 5 different kitchens. We'd have back prep for all the dirty stuff, say the soil, the blood, the fish and everything like that. Then you'd have the old service kitchen was where we'd set up for service, that everything that crossed through that door had to be perfect already. You wouldn't have, you're not prepping in that kitchen. You're just like picking things down. Then we'd have a pastry kitchen, the test kitchen, and then the service kitchen. So service kitchen was behind like glass doors, but everything was cleaned 5 times a day. We'd bring every guest around the whole kitchen, give them a tour of the kitchen, show them our dry aging room, our fermenting room, the pastry room. So like we're on the top of a football stadium. So in around all the walkways, you could see into the football stadium. And then they have concerts, like Beyonce played there, Rammstein played there. Like it was, when that Rammstein was on, it was just like the bass was just going through the kitchen like crazy. All the guests were like, what is that noise? And just the windows were shaking and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was crazy.
It's like a bit different for a setting like Duranium.
Yeah, Rammstein.
Yeah, so the story behind that, like he had Duranium first got built in like a little park in the middle of Copenhagen City. And he was there for 1.5 years, had 1 star, won the first Bocuse there. Then he got had problems with the investors at that place, so he was looking for a new spot. Someone came to him with this eight story off a it's a football stadium, but it has a lot of offices on the lower levels. And he walked in there and it's just like hot dog, chips and fine dining food, like it's not gonna work. Walked away. Came back 2 weeks later and it's just like no one's done it before. Like if anyone can do it, sort of he could do it with the investor that he had, Lasaya. So he now owns Alchemist, the new Alchemist. He's the investor for that, and he's got Duranium as well. He's got a few other restaurants, but he's sort of the backing behind Duranium. So that's one thing I don't miss about Duranium was seeing the food costs. Like there is no food cost and the wastage, unfortunately. So now we have a sister restaurant, they have a sister restaurant, but it was just like, just to seeing what it takes to get to that level.
Yeah, like, that level is kind of inherently wasteful.
Yeah.
Just because everything has to be perfect, and that means discarding the non-perfect stuff, and straight away that becomes, wasteful in nature. Even like lining up little fillets of beef by taking the ends off so they're neat. Like those ends are perfectly fine.
Yeah.
You can eat them, but
I don't know how many times I made lemon thyme ice cream for staff just because we'd cut the top 4 flower leaves off, and then the rest would go in the bin. So I was just welcome. Staff can't eat red sorrel, like the ends of the red sorrel, so what are we going to do? Oh, let's make a panna cotta or something out of it. Just do staff food as much as you can for staff food. Just do that. So
So tell us about the sort of relationship with vegetables at Duranium. Obviously, like you were telling us before about you had greenhouses in the kitchen, there were the farms that you worked with, that reverence for vegetables that sort of made you develop your understanding of vegetables and how to cook them.
Yeah, so just seeing that sort of care in vegetables, like even the farmers come in with like everything lined up perfectly, still with dirt on it, like they don't clean it for us because they want to show you how like it was pulled up literally this morning. all the wild plants. So we had, I think we had four farmers that just work for us. So one guy would just get all the wild seeds and plant it out the back of his house. So he'd have the wild plants, but still be able to manage it himself, not have to go out and find all these wild plants. We had a mushroom forager who also did a few other restaurants, but whenever she'd find something, she'd message one of the sous chefs and be like, I found this, you want it? And just be like, yeah, we have morels in that day. So it was just, when the mushroom season's on, it's just, it's crazy. You're just getting it to process it. Yeah. So either drying it, pickling it, things like that. And then we had a big farm. So like we'd plan our menus for say 3 months and we'd tell him what we want planted in that season. And then if it was changing season, we'd get the first, whatever starts shooting up first, we'd get it into the kitchen. We'd start doing our tests with it, figure out what dish it's going to go on, if it's going to be a new dish, if it's going to be a reiteration of an old dish. So a lot of the, say, the sauces were kept the same because they were just super tasty and we just alternate between the vegetables of the season. And yeah, like Rasmus is now fully plant-based diet and he's got a plant-based sister restaurant inside Geranium during COVID. So his mentality with vegetables were make them the star. And the protein sort of the side, as much as what we did process the proteins into very beautiful pieces of meat, but a lot more care got taken into the wild plants and the fresh sort of vegetables.
What does, you mentioned testing when you're getting ingredients in and things like that. What does testing look like? Because, I mean, you know, Simon, you had a restaurant and stuff. Like, how often did you have stuff? Did you have stuff that often that would come in? You're like, okay, let's do like a lot of testing. I assume at Geranium, it's like a very meticulous process, right?
Yeah. So there was, rhubarb was coming into season, and we wanted to see what we could do with rhubarb. So between the three chefs, it was three senior chefs. It's like, what techniques do we know how to process rhubarb? And we needed to do it in 0.5%, 1%, 1.5%, 2%, 2.5%. Every recipe needed to be gradients of that, and then all need to be separated. And then we'd have them all into little boxes. Rasmus would come in, taste everything, and just sort of put it together and create the dish. So some things took, like the razor clam dish, took 4 years to figure out how to do it perfectly. And then there was another dish I was setting up for a function, and it was the salmon dish that's on the trout dish that's on the menu now. We made that dish in 10 minutes. He just told me to grab this ingredient, let's blend this, make this sauce, make that. And we did it in 10 minutes and still on the menu now. It's had a facelift, but like we got the flavors down in 10 minutes, but it looked like crap. It wasn't Geranium standard. It was like, it looked like a mousse, looked like dog poo. But then, yeah, just as soon as we got the flavors down, we're like, all right, how can we figure this better? So we go buy molds. We go make a trout cotton. So it takes 2 months to dry trout out to blend it up to make it look like fairy floss. And then it was make the sauce, which was done on the first day. And then now it has like this seaweed twill over the top of the mousse. Looks like a piece of art. And then it's just added. So that dish is now a three-part dish. There's like a tart with the trout cotton, and then there's a cured like gravlax with juniper, and then there's the trout mousse with the grilled kohlrabi and sheep's butter sauce with the lattice now. So originally it was just the mousse and the sauce. That was the first.
Kind of like the different tests you do is sometimes you can throw a dish together with preparations, techniques, ingredients you already know, and it might be a new interpretation of them. And then some things you're like, I want to treat this different, or you might even like be reverse engineering it. Like, I want this to look like that. How can I do that? But like a lot of times it's just, you know, it's a bit of trial and error. Like the amount of time I spent trying to get crocodile into a place that I wanted it, and just trying everything I knew and then trying to read and being like thinking outside the box. And then that was something that took a couple months of trial and error and refining to get into a place I thought it was actually tasty and not just like, fucking someone slapped a bit of crocodile on a grill, which basically tastes like almost any other way you cook it. Like quick, slow, fucking sous vide, oven, always just tastes the same. It's weird meat.
Is that level of testing, is that something that you like as a chef?
I loved at the time because it's something I've never done before.
Right.
My testing was just like watch a video online and then just go in the kitchen and just figure it out, do a couple of trials. It worked out okay, but there it needed to be like perfect. Like before I hit the menu, it needed to be like, yeah, perfect kind of thing.
Yeah, and then it goes through the process of getting signed off as a dish to hit the menu, and then it goes on
pretty much. So it was figure out the components, figure out, like, he'd sort of give us a flavor profile. Like, I saw the sous chef before me. She got told to make a roasted grain and pear dessert. So she was on there for like 2 weeks, I think, just like burning grains, roasting grains, pulsing grains, try to make the best infusion that she could to then make it into a mousse, and then figure out what we can do with pears. And then it ended up being poach pears, dehydrate them, rehydrate them back into pear juice. So they kind of turned like toffee. So that was like the main components. And then there was, caramel, add caramel to it, add chamomile to it. And then it was just like add these little touches to sort of elevate it into something that would be served at Geranium. So everyone would.
It's got to be like, we sort of found it over the years of Kavo, is that you get to a point where it becomes harder and harder to introduce a new dish.
Yeah.
When we were first starting, it was very much just throw heaps of shit and then you grab some stuff you like, and that worked and that worked. And after a while, when she's trying to replace a dish and you got to a point where you really like that dish, it just becomes more and more difficult. And imagine at that level, at, you know, 3-star level, when lots on the line, to put a new dish on the menu to replace another dish, it has to be that perfect.
Yeah. So Geranium's menu was a lot of signature dishes. So there was probably, out of the 18 dishes, there was probably, I'd say, 10 to 12 signatures that just wouldn't change. There was a comment from a few guests saying, oh, the menu never changes. And then the signature dishes, we just either put them on a new plate, or just like the scallop stones change between the season, between scallop, mackerel and trout. And then the dill flavor got changed to beetroot, and then it didn't have a granita with it. It just had a horseradish loose cream. He'd come in one day and be like, we're doing beetroot stones. Make a recipe, Paul. I'm like, what? Like, just beetroot juice. It was gelatin, salt, figure that out, dip it the same, triple dip it so it's nice and dark, and then things like that. He's like, oh, the cucumber granita doesn't go with it. Let's just make a looser horseradish cream, figure out what garnish we're going to put on it. And then it was just covered in these pink and white Elysium flowers, which looked amazing. I still prefer the dill stones, but it was just like a comment saying, doesn't really change. So he didn't want to take them off because they were such a signature. He just like reinvent them in a way.
And that level as well, like, people are going to have those dishes they've seen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the amount of people who would dine there multiple times a year, it's like, you guys can eat the fucking same thing.
Yeah.
If you eat Geranium twice in a year, or twice in 2 years, then you can just fucking put up with Eric.
I saw the same guest maybe come in 10 times in 1 year. I'm like, how can you afford? Like, obviously people have money, but I was like, how can you not be like, oh, the menu, it's the same.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it's not like we don't change it that much. Yeah. We change it 3-4 times maximum, but it's only mainly the last 4 or 5 savory options. They're the ones that change, between the proteins and sort of the more vegetable dishes. All the snacks are pretty signatures. After I've left, he's done a lot of revamping all the snacks. So it's the same sort of flavor profiles. It's just a lot more tableside stuff. So just because he's pushing to get number one, I'm guessing.
Yeah, right.
50 best, so.
What we'll start sort of transitioning into the year of the veg here at Overlow and that sort of thing. But like, there seems to be this odd contradiction in a way, in that and he's probably the best person to ask about it. Rasmus is probably the best person to ask about it. But to revere vegetables and be plant-based and pescatarian and stuff, a lot of the time those decisions are based on sustainability.
Yep.
Yet at a restaurant, you mentioned the wastage. Like, was that kind of squared away in a way that putting these vegetables on a pedestal gives them the opportunity, you know, to be revered and utilized elsewhere? Like, where does and he's the person to ask, so it sucks having to ask you this, but did you think about that? Like, you know, we're showcasing vegetables at this level and sustainability comes into the picture, yet we're wasting a lot?
Yeah, so that's sort of what I'm trying to do here at Monster Kitchen Bar.
Yeah.
So still, like, seeing all the waste that happens at Geranium, obviously you can't really help it. You try to do your best to make sure the orders are on point so you're not, like, wasting things that could have been used elsewhere. But yeah, here at Monster Kitchen and Bar, I'm trying to use byproducts of recipes to use other things. So a lot of the stuff is reinventing. So make tomato water or the dried pulp, dehydrate it, smoke it, and then make an oil out of it to go into another dish. Or the mushrooms, get the juice in the oven and then turn the pulp into cheeseburgers or turn that into the karaage that's on the menu. So a lot of the process of the vegetables are getting reused as much as possible on our current menu, and there'll be room to grow even further. So trying our best to limit the amount of stuff that goes in landfill. And we do have actually it's called an Orca machine out the back. So it decomposes all our green waste, except for avocado seeds and pineapple tops, because it's too fibrous. But yeah, pretty much just breaks, it's got hazelnut shells inside, breaks it all down into water for our own garden. So yeah, trying to limit the footprint that we're leaving.
All right, we'll get on to more about it, specifically what you're doing with the sustainability on the menu here. But let's talk about the year of the veg more broadly. When can you tell us about this sort of first conversation you had with the people from Ovalo and their idea for, like, for those who don't know, maybe you should just give us an idea of what they're doing with this, the Year of the Veg, because it's a pretty bold and revolutionary concept across a whole chain of hotels and restaurants.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, Ovalo Hotel decided, not sure if it was like the concept Year of the Veg when it was decided, but when I took the job, it was just as a plant-based kitchen. And then coming down here, then I got informed that, yeah, it's going to be 365 days of veg across the whole hotel brand. First hotel to do it in the world. And yeah, we pretty much went live on the 29th of last month.
Yeah. 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yeah. So did a little soft launch, but yeah, pretty much it was a few restaurants were already vegetarian by then. But there was three or four that weren't vegetarian. So we all just swapped it all out. So the idea behind that came from obviously the owner, based in Hong Kong. So he just wants to limit the footprint that everyone's making on the world, being environmentally conscious, sustainability, healthy eating, trying to change the ways of people and promote the vegetables in the way that they can be, in a way. So everyone's got their own little agendas, all the different exec chefs around Australia putting their own little spin on it. But we come together once a month to sort of figure out what everyone's doing, where we're going to go. Like we did a launch in Sydney, I think a month ago, just to bring some influencers in and stuff like that, and do the first meet up with the three executive chefs and do a menu up there, which was kind of cool.
And so that first conversation, was that like when you first got recruited, did you know that you'd be cooking just vegetables?
So I applied for the job mainly based on cooking vegetables and being plant-based. Like I said to you guys before, I know I can cook meat and fish. I just know that vegetables is something I was always trying to promote at my previous job. There was always veggie dishes doing really, like at the end, when the guests would leave off the island, they would be like, what's your favorite dish? And they'd be like the beetroot or the carrot or the celeriac. They'd forget about all the fish that was caught out the front of the island. That would be like their star moment off the menu. So just knowing that I can cook vegetables in that kind of way and having a challenge like Monster Kitchen, where the reputation that it had before, and try to bring it back into Canberra. Just to test myself as well. That was one of the reasons why I like a challenge. So being restricted, not restricted, I wouldn't say it's a bad word, but
You almost got to do a bit convincing with people.
Yeah.
Like meat kind of speaks for itself, and people will order the steak, the beef, the lamb. Yeah.
Nothing to hide behind.
Yeah, it really isn't. And you kind of also got less leeway. Like if you overcook a carrot, people are really going to notice if that's like one of the only things on the plate.
That's it.
And vegetables can be super interesting if we start cooking them like meat. Yeah. I'm sure that's what I've always found. Is things like brining, smoking, even like dry curing. these are all awesome techniques that work with vegetables really well, and make them inherently more interesting rather than just like how my mum would do it. Fucking boil
everything. I think also there's like you can apply techniques to vegetables that people are unfamiliar with, and that is very exciting to diners. Like I have a lot of friends that are plant-based or veggie or, you know, pescatarian, whatever. And you go to a restaurant, you know, and you like a good restaurant, inform them in advance that you've got ex-vegans and ex-veggies coming, and they've got something organized. And when that is really well considered and really well executed in a different way, whatever it might be, like the hero of it might be a piece of celeriac or something like you say, but it's got a texture and a flavor that you just have never had before in a vegetable, that's more exciting than a really well-cooked piece of protein in some way, because it's a new dimension.
It can kind of be easy to impress people with that as well. Like, if you, it's like if you cook anything, people overcook vegetables and fuck vegetables all the time and just cook them in the most basic, simple ways, like boil or roast. So if you do something to vegetables and you cook them precisely, seasons well, flavors work well, like straight away people will be like, oh my God, never had anything like that. And it's quite hard to do that with meat because people have had meat so many different ways.
Yeah.
So like it's like I always say the same thing with like chicken. If you get a good chicken and cook it well, people like lose their shit. People are just like, oh my God, it's so good, because everyone fucks chicken. Literally, figuratively. They fuck vegetables.
So. How have you then, like when you were writing this first menu for Monster, I mean, you are a hotel restaurant and you probably have guests here that don't know that you've got a vegetarian only menu. Like the appetites that you have to cater for are varied between people who come here specifically because it's a vegetarian menu, to people who don't know it's a vegetarian menu, to everything in between, and people that are just here on business and want to have a meal.
Yep.
It must be pretty tough considering all those different things into writing that first menu. What have you sort of done?
100%. So originally the idea was to go plant-based in the whole hotel group. And then sort of the question got put up there, is just like sort of jumping a little bit too far ahead, like to be able to bring the clientele in, and then having that chance to use eggs, butter, cheese, things like that was I would say a God's gift on the first menu. Definitely want to transition to more vegan options, not that we don't have many at the moment, but having those sort of richer dishes for the carnivores to eat, and to be satisfied at the end of the day. So we've had a lot of guest feedback come in and they said, yeah, we're bona fide carnivores, but we are so impressed by the menu, we're coming back to eat the vegetarian menu. And then we get some people come to the door who don't even want to take a chance at that kind of thing. So we'll try to send out something as a snack, just to be like, oh look, it's not what you think. It's not too scary. It's not some salad on a plate kind of thing. So it's definitely gonna impress. And yeah, we've had people come from Sydney who say they didn't know it was vegetarian. We're gonna make more chance to come down from Sydney just to eat at Monster kind of thing. So hearing that sort of those reviews, it's good to see that it's getting received well. Here, just need a little bit more traffic, I think, so social and stuff like that, to bring people in. Once they have a chance to eat it, they'll come back again. So menu at the moment is a little bit smaller. Just when I came here, it was sort of just after COVID, so I didn't have much of a team at the beginning. Now we're nearly fully stocked in the kitchen, so hoping to do a new menu by Christmas with more options, and then implement a set menu for the restaurant, because we're only open 3 nights a week in this room. But yeah, still the lobby needs to be enough choices for them kind of thing. So it's always going to develop, evolve. The menus, obviously seasonal, everything like that. So trying to stay as local as possible, speak with the farmers and things like that.
Have you met any farmers around here yet?
So I've spoken to the mushroom farmers, because we're going through a lot of mushrooms on our menu.
Which ones out at
Gouda Creek?
Gouda Creek, yeah.
Yeah, so Gouda Creek. Spoken to them about getting some wild mushrooms. Just because we're going through that much. I've hit a few people up on social. I just need to get a bit of time off in my day to go on.
Bit of time to bloody
to go out and do these kind of,
things. Need an extra couple of hours.
Develop those relationships. Well, you will find that Canberra has a really, really good abundance of great local producers. And have you been down to the Epic Markets yet on a Saturday?
I have. Yeah, I have.
It's a good place to hit up.
Yeah, I wanted to go pick everyone's brains, but it was a little bit too busy. I didn't think they want to talk to somebody who's not going to buy anything.
Yeah. Oh, they want to talk to chefs for sure. Just get there early before like the hordes arrive.
Yeah.
I think. Epic.
It's Exhibition Park in Canberra. It's an acronym.
I think it's closed.
Yeah,
I think it's closed at the moment. I saw a sign just saying it's closed. I mean, maybe it's just driving access, but
But yeah, like Canberra, like having grown up here in Canberra and now living in Wollongong, Canberra has a farmers market culture better than probably any town its size in Australia. Like it's amazing. We've got Exhibition Park out there, and then there's the Southside Farmers Markets on Sundays, and a couple of other ones around town. So it's a good place to meet producers. I'm sure
we we have a good relationship with Pialago Estate.
Yep.
So it's another just a place down the road. Mm-hmm. So I've spoken to their farmer down there. Once they get sort of everything up and on track for their season, they might have some land for us to plant some stuff, or if they've got excess wastage, I'll just come send it to me. I'll preserve it, stuff like that. Mm. Give it back to them, kind of thing. So there was plums last year, 600 kilos of plums they gave to the kitchen.
Amazing.
And then 3 days later, they had to compost it because the chefs were too busy to do anything with it. Bummer. So I heard that. I was just like, damn.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a challenge? Like, as you were saying, you know, you're waiting for that traffic to build, and it's only 2 weeks in. Into this new menu and into the year of the veg, do you think there's a challenge in being a part of a, you know, an international hotel group? Because I feel like in Australia, one thing that Australians are good at is recognizing small business, like and really like investing in the people and the inner workings of privately owned businesses or Australian owned hospitality groups. Is there a challenge being an international hotel group where people might think, well, that's an international hotel group, like the restaurants and the food can't be at the level that we expect or whatever it might be?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because Monster Kitchen is like, it's the lobby as well, like the bar, it's got a good vibe, so like
it's amazing, the space.
Yeah, before the menu change, it was pretty much on a Monday to Saturday, the lobby was full. It was bumping. The bar was just full, kind of thing. And I'm not sure if it's now because we sort of changed it when the borders started opening. I'm not sure if people are sort of venturing out, but I've heard Canberra itself is a little bit quiet at the moment. So I'm not sure if that's affecting.
It's a pretty hard time to estimate.
It's a hard time to make judgments.
Is this busy for this time of year?
Yeah.
What was it like last pandemic? Oh fuck, we don't.
Yeah.
It's hard. Yeah, it's hard to make anything.
Yeah, it's hard to do a judgment.
Going forward is like, how do you staff? How do you work out how much produce you need in these uncertain times? I mean, it's a challenge across the board. Yeah. For chefs and people in charge of ordering and rostering and all these things.
Cool. Just a bit more on the year of the veg and we'll start wrapping it up, but tell us a bit about you were explaining a bit before that all the different exec chefs across all the different overload venues are sort of putting their own spin on how they're approaching the year of the veg and that sort of creative freedom that you guys have. And you guys do sort of work together, like come together monthly and things like that?
Yeah, so we'll have like a monthly meeting with all the general managers, execs and sort of directors and stuff like that, sort of to set the game plan in motion for the next, say, 2 month period, set timelines, menu changes across the board. So we'll all sort of have a cohesive flow between the sort of menus, just so one's not offering 30 dishes and one's offering 10. So we'll try to have, everyone's got their own sort of style. Zaza Thai in Brisbane's got Middle Eastern, Mediterranean sort of vibe to it. Willamaloo's plant-based. Fresh.
Completely plant-based?
They opened up as plant-based.
Oh, right, so okay.
Yeah, so they never was vegetarian. They've just been 100% plant-based over there. So seeing what they're doing up there with with Matthew Kenny from US. So he's like the consultant. So the stuff that he's, all the recipes that he's like sending through to the guys, like their pastry and high tea over there is just out of this world. Like,
yeah, right.
Their pastry chef is crazy. All the bread, cultured butters, like the vegan butters, vegan cheeses, all that kind of stuff is really cool. So yeah, they're a little bit smaller than us, Woolloomooloo, for the restaurant side, but they have a big function space up there. And then coming down to Monster, so that's the three like main ones. We have a few more sort of smaller properties, but they're the three biggest. And then Monster is like, it's been very Japanese based for the past few years. And then yeah, coming on board, being sort of, again, don't like to say restricted, but having to be Japanese and vegetarian was sort of a little bit limiting. So we kind of went on the way of like new world sustainability, like sort of seasonality, farm produce driven. That's sort of our concept here. And then yeah, so there'll be a little bit of flavors from around the world down at Monster.
Awesome, exciting. All right, probably, have you got any last things? I've got one more question really, and then we'll wrap it up. Simon, you got anything else?
Well, I would sit and chat about testing recipes for hours, but it might not be the most interesting to start talking about brine percentages and stuff. So you go, Steph.
Yeah, well, like, I just want to talk about some of the dishes on the menu. Like, have you sort of earmarked anything as a signature dish or something that you'd really want people to order when they come?
Definitely, like, well, the sellers, the hit sellers right now are the karaage, the mushroom karaage, the churros, the cauliflower.
What's the churros?
Churros, the parmesan churros. So okay. It's a vegan parmesan we're getting from up near Byron. Nimbin, sorry.
Yep.
So with the truff chili cheddar fondue. So truff is another US brand truffle hot sauce.
Mm-hmm. How's the parmesan working? Like, I've used, my girlfriend's vegan, I've used vegan cheese like on pizza and stuff.
Yeah.
And like that just like melting point and texture.
Yeah.
That is like parmesan, isn't it? Yeah.
Vegan,
it's not vegan.
Parmesan.
No, this
is that real parmesan?
Yeah.
I thought they said
this one's the vegan parmesan.
Yeah, this one's vegan parmesan. Yeah. Sorry, my bad.
Parmesan has animal rennet inside.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, like, how's that cooking with products like that? It's like, how's like the reaction to it? Like,
it's been, again, a little bit of testing and stuff like that to figure out the ratios and stuff like that to bind the karaage that we need to use the vegan egg.
Yeah,
the chickpea sort of blend.
Okay,
to help bind it, so when it heats, it stays together instead of disintegrating in the fryer. But yeah, so a lot of the stuff like I've done with proteins, like the carrot terrine, used to do like mosaics of meat.
At
geranium, and then trying to figure out how that can hold without any binding agents for service.
Yeah,
and heating it up. So I think it's a lot of trial and error figuring that stuff out. But definitely the ancient grains is a winner as well. That's super tasty.
It looks amazing.
It's four different grains cooked for a few hours and then just sort of added like a ragu, add some ancient grain oats to it and just sort of work it to get all that starchy creaminess out of it. Like the vegan dishes are the ones that are sort of killers. Cheesecake. It's one I stole from Woolloomooloo, their cheesecake recipe from their pastry chef. And then just did my sort of garnish to it. But yeah, just haven't played around with many like the vegan recipes. A few. But yeah, that's sort of my next phase is to get more of the vegan options.
Yeah, cool. Lots of exciting stuff coming up for the next year, for the year of the veg.
100%. 100%. Yeah. Christmas will be a banger.
Yeah, nice.
12 course geranium style menu.
Oh, really? Yeah, is cool. That what it's going
to
be?
Yeah, we're working on it. So just going to need to write a menu for it and then start doing the testings for the general managers to taste and then figure out how I can do 100 portions.
Anything else you want to mention before we finish?
No, I'm pretty good.
Pretty good?
Pretty good. Awesome. Pretty good. Pretty happy.
Awesome. Paul, thank you so much for joining us, mate. Great to chat.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's simon_evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.